Okay, well, good morning. Thank you for coming to our panel this morning. I have the privilege of introducing our panelists today. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I am president of Tech Talk Studio in San Francisco. Our program this morning is called A New Culture of Learning, Gaming, Tech, and Design. And this program is all about the intersection of gaming, technology, all kinds of approaches to design and design thinking, and also blended learning and some classic learning theory as it is now being disrupted by thinking with people like Clay Christensen. So I'm very excited to have our program here today. It's an amazing intersection of our speakers and what they're going to be talking about. So I'd like to ask our speakers to please introduce themselves, and we'll start there.
Wonderful. Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Nicole Lazzaro, and I make games more fun. For the past 20 years, I've been researching and designing why games and how games create engagement. I've had the privilege of working on a number of best-selling titles for companies like EA, or for games, I should say, so from EA, Ubisoft, PlayFirst, such as Diner Dash and The Sims. And I'm here to share with you a little bit about my perspective on games, game playing, and emotion. I run a company called Zio Design, and we do game consulting, and we also are developing a game, which we'll show you a little bit, an educational game. In my research, I've got a model called the Four Keys to Fun that's been downloaded by hundreds of thousands of developers worldwide. And I guess the other thing that I should say is that I've also invented the first game, the very first game on the iPhone to use the accelerometer. In a game called Tilt. So that's me, and welcome.
Hi, my name is Scott Stropke. I entered this learning space really starting in art school, which was the first time that I'd, because we had a two-year humanities program where we had to learn history and art history and literature together. It was the first time in my educational experience where I started to connect the dots between what's happening in the world and how ideas affect the world and how culture is transformed. So from in art school, though, I pursued design and spent a number of years at Fitch and IDEO building teams, attacking all kinds of problems. In the last 10 years, I started a company with Richard Watson called Essential Design in Boston, and we were a design consulting firm who is working on all kinds of interesting problems that are education and motivation related in sort of the working world. We're helping a company called MeU Health learn to motivate everybody in the country to be more healthy. We've developed financial literacy ideas for the ARP because your grandparents are more worried about your financial future than their own. So we focused on 25-year-olds. We've been helping companies like Under Armour develop metrics for performance for super high-end athletes. So measuring has become part of our work. But I guess from an education point of view, we've been asked by all kinds of business schools in the community, Babson and BC and Duke and Harvard, to introduce design processes to the business school curriculum. And most recently, we've been applying what we've learning there to some K through 12 applications. So thanks for coming.
My name's Heather Staker, and my first exposure to the education world began when I was a senior in high school. I was a student member on the State Board of Education in California, and California actually awards one student member the opportunity to have full voting privileges. So even though I grew up in Southern California, I spent half of my senior year living in Sacramento in a hotel room as a student member on the State Board of Education, so I became really exposed to the system and the Department of Education and how it works in terms of the bureaucracy. I then went on to attend Harvard and then Harvard Business School, where I became very familiar with the work of Professor Clayton Christensen, who many recognize as the father of innovation theory. And I now work for his nonprofit think tank based in Mountain View, California, called Innosight Institute, where we apply theories of innovation and disruptive innovation to the healthcare and education sectors in hopes that through innovation, we'll be able to help solve some of the problems that are really vexing those industries. I also have a heart for the entrepreneur. I worked for McKinsey consulting for a while with a focus on social enterprise and thinking about how do you actually sell into some of these for-profit, non-profit, government type of sectors. And then also I have four children who are in the elementary school right now, so I bring a heart, sort of a mother's heart to this about thinking about the system, and we'll bring our fifth child into this world in a few more months. And so I really am thinking about schooling with that kind of a passion as well.
All right, well, thank you. So I'd like to start off with a question for each of you. What is an ideal student-centric learning system, and where do we start? What do we need to do? Nicole, would you like to start?
Certainly, yeah. Well, from my perspective, the ideal learning situation is, of course, games. What we forget about is that what's forgotten about too often is that play is essential. This essential step between who we are now and who we are about to become. It's where we role play our future selves. And in addition to the rote memorization of facts and figures, we also have this opportunity to explore new worlds, new content, and new ideas. And we take this for granted with children. We take this for granted. But with adults, we kind of forget that play is also a very important part about what learning is. Because, in fact, all games, every game that you have ever played teaches. It can't be a game and not teach. You have to have something to master, right? There has to be some progression. And so there's these wonderful sets of mechanics that I first became interested in when I was a student at Stanford studying, cognitive psychology, in that there is this wonderful property of games to create engagement, but then also to, develop new skills. Games are sort of this mental mechanica, if you will. They're these gymnasiums for the mind. They're this way of us looking at a system, looking at a situation, and then resolving those problems. There's wonderful problem solving. And so for what we're doing now is we're actually developing this game called Tilt World, which is all about what we call an eco-mechanica. And I brought just a short video clip here to show you. This is a character named Flip and decides to restore Shady Glen by eating carbon out of the air. So if we can go ahead and roll that.
Oops.
Go back. So just click back arrow. Just click the back arrow once and then, yeah. And then click anywhere on the screen. There you go. That's fine. Cool. So this is the opening cinematic. So the game takes place in Shady Glen that's decimated by this blight, and our little character, Flip, is a happy tadpole eating carbon, as you see here, out of the air. This is based, and then gathering mushrooms to detoxify the soil. This is based on Paul Stamets' mushroom research. Now, because it's a game, we're going to increase challenge slightly here. So we've got a slightly harder puzzle. You can't touch anything that's got the green blight on it. And then as you advance, you are going to do additional topics, such as controlling erosion by planting dandelion seeds. Here you can actually use wind by swiping on the screen to control the drops. And then what's fun is we can actually, all of the seeds that the player earns can then be donated to WeForest. And WeForest is going to use this to plant these virtual seeds in the real world as mangrove trees in the island of Madagascar. So we're going to be planting a million mangrove trees in Madagascar as a result of this game. So if you can imagine, we're collecting virtual seeds. Students collect virtual seeds, and those end up as real-world trees. And that completes the cycle, and that's a very important part of play. In that you have an objective, you accomplish that objective, you win, and then something happens. The gameplay changes the player, or it changes the world somehow.
Okay, well, Scott, what about your approach to design and learning?
Well, in my opinion, an ideal student-centric learning process is like a design process. Design is applied creativity, and what's what I love about what Nicole's sharing about games is games create this amazing context for you to live in, to work in, these boundaries that are understood. And design does a very similar thing, but that can be a little bit more open-ended, where you don't know exactly where you're what you're going to create at the end of the day. So design problems are very interesting problems when you ask a group of students to solve a problem, to fix something that's important to them. It can really engage them in research into the activity. There's usually a personal component. It's usually a people component. You have to ask people how they look at the problem. You want to look into the history of it. You want to document brainstorming concepts as solutions from the design process. You're prototyping ideas and then you're putting them out there to test those ideas, and that can be an amazing learning experience when your idea doesn't work like you think it's going to work, or when a student doesn't use something the way you think they're going to use it. So that process that is just super personal, super engaging, and super motivating to kids. My son just have an eighth grader who because the teacher just inadvertently didn't define a science project very well, he took the opportunity to kind of make it his own. So he decided to make a windmill for his science class, and because the problem was so ill-defined, he got to decide what kind of windmill. He got to decide how big it was. He wanted to make a windmill that could power a light bulb for people. He wanted to make it affordable, so he started to think about the materials that he could use. He had to figure out the transmission of the energy. He had to work on gear systems. He had to design an electric motor, and that didn't work the first time or the second time. So he learned the process of building, how to make something like that come together. And it was fascinating to watch, but even more fascinating to read the paper he had to write about it. So again, weaving in core academics into the delivery, he talked about the history of windmills and why he wanted to do something that was affordable, how he tuned the materials to be stuff that you could buy at Home Depot, so that he could power a light bulb for disadvantaged people. So the translation of all that learning into a project that he could share was, help build his self-esteem. He saw himself as a true creator, as an innovator, as a thinker, as a historian. It was everything in one place, and it's super empowering. So, in my opinion, an ideal future learning system is a design-based learning system.
Okay, well, Heather, would you like to tell us about you?
So it's interesting. So Nicole has sort of painted this picture of how games can help students learn, and the idea that they could achieve points in a virtual reality that would correspond to real trees being planted in Madagascar. And Scott has mentioned the idea of project-based learning and his son building this windmill and having that be a richer experience. And I definitely agree with those ideas that it makes sense intuitively that not all students learn the same. And so having options and having different ways for students to access the material makes sense. You think about the School of One in New York City, and its founding premise was choose your modality. And the idea that students should have options so that if some students learn best math with Montessori blocks, like physical manipulatives, and some learn best through more of a game-like experience, and some through constructing some kind of a project that spatially arranges the geometric shapes, and that's how they learn math best, that you could right-size each student's custom play list with a learning algorithm that would specifically slot each student into the right type of learning experience for that specific concept, for that specific course. And I think that that's what we mean when we're talking about student-centric learning. In Florida Virtual School, their tagline is student control over time, place, path, and pace. And those are the four elements that I think seem to kind of provide the contours of what we're talking about when we're talking about personalization and student control. The idea that students could control their timing. In Wichita, Kansas, they have these drop-in centers for students who might have work obligations or childcare responsibilities, and so they can't attend a traditional high school. And so they co-locate these drop-in centers in shopping malls and have them be open like 24 hours a day with credentialed teachers on site and online learning kiosks where the kids can do learning in a non-traditional way and make up high school credit and get their diplomas. So that's time. Place. There's a school in New Mexico called the Albuquerque Academy that's allowing students to work on their own as long as they maintain at least a C grade point average. Otherwise, they're back into the brick and mortar setting. But as long as they're like their grades are okay, then they can work wherever they want to and they can use their mobile devices. Pathway, like I talked about, the School of One in New York City, but the idea of choose your own modality and allowing kids to customize based on what works best for them. And then pacing. It's really interesting. There's some kids in Northern California who are doing Khan Academy in fifth grade, and they're already in calculus. The idea of untethering students from this monolithic single classroom pace and allowing them to move forward as quickly or as slowly as they need to really master the material. So I think those are all really compelling ideas and make sense intuitively. The challenge here and sort of the mystery is, why is it that since the late 1800s we've had a factory-based system that's basically monolithic, such that students predominantly learn in a single classroom with teacher-led instruction and they advance at the pace of the classroom? According to the dictates of the calendar year and the confines of that brick-and-mortar setting. So I think that while we talk about these modalities that are like promising and encouraging and seem to make more sense from what we know about how students learn best, the challenge and the real question for entrepreneurs and for people who are thinking about this space is, how do we get into a system that's been basically the same for 150 years and that 89% of students in America, of K-12 students in America, attend a public school. The rest attend like a private school or maybe homeschooled. But we're looking at the vast majority of students who are part of a system that's very entrenched. And so as much as we talk about student-centric learning, how do we make that a reality that we can actually do something about in the here and now?
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. There needs to be a wide variety of things to support students of different needs. And it is true, not all students want to play games or want to learn playing games. But I think we also need to recognize that this paper and this paper book is going away as far as the only mechanism by which we learn. And if you take your curriculum online, you can interact with that curriculum. If you can interact with it, it's not going to be just turning pages. So even though some students may not want to play a game specifically, the interactions, light game-like interactions, are going to infuse the educational curriculum from top to bottom. We have true, false, and multiple choice and essay questions now. We're going to have simulation questions, coming real near in the future, where if you master the simulation, you're actually mastering that content. And it may feel like a game or it may not feel like a game, like it's optional, like it's fun. Well, of course, it'll be fun because you're learning. Learning's fun for most people. Anyway, so we've got this really interesting thing that's going to be happening where these games are going to inspire new ways of going through. Everyone has a LinkedIn profile here. There's a couple games on LinkedIn already. You've got that progress bar that fills up as you complete your profile. That's a game. And in order to do that, you have to play a second game, which is a group quest. You have to go get recommendations from other friends in order to complete that mission.
Yeah, and I think that the beauty of this idea of simulation is that it's also relatively efficient. It takes a long time to build a physical thing in space, especially if it's collaborative and you're going through all steps of a design process, for instance. But to take parts of that offline and play with variables and simulators, like the astronauts play with variables and simulators, is probably the most immersive and rich learning experience that you could create.
So I think one of the things that's interesting, though, is that we talk about these opportunities that are so enriching and immersive, and yet we're faced with the reality of the majority of students really having that not be part of their world yet. But I do think that there is definite reason for optimism. I mean, you look at the U.S. Postal Service, they certainly didn't expect to have email come along. So we definitely have precedent for even highly government industries to suddenly be disrupted by innovative forces that creep in from places that they don't even expect. And I think we are seeing signs of that right now.
Okay, well, that leads into our next question that I wanted to ask, and I'm going to start with Nicole. So what is working? What really can make a difference right now?
Well, great. Well, based on our research on emotion and the fun of games, there's four things that you can use in either if you're designing a specific educational game, or you just want to add some of that engagement into traditional curriculum. And this is what we call the four keys to fun. And what we found is that when we looked at people playing games, home, school, and work, young and old, male and female, everything from Tetris, a light game like Tetris on one hand, to a first-person war game like, you know, Halo or Call of Duty, is that players enjoyed games in really four different ways. We measured the emotions that players had on their faces. We used Paul Ekman's facial action coding and measured seven emotions on the face, other emotions in the body. Then we grouped these moments in time, players' favorite moments again, grouped them by the emotions that they were feeling. And it turns out that different emotions have had a lot of similarities. We looked at those moments and said, well, what's going on? What kind of actions, what kind of choices, what kind of mechanics were happening in each of these four groups? And it turns out there were a lot of similarities. Best-selling games and people's favorite games tend to do these four things. They tend to offer novelty, something we call easy fun. It inspires curiosity, wonder, and surprise, exploration, and role play. Next, they tend to provide challenge, not surprisingly. Curiosity is that hook that pulls them in with easy fun, and then you want something to do. So you want to be able to put a basketball into a hoop. You want to have a goal. You want to feel frustrated towards that goal, not too frustrated, but a little frustrated, in order to feel the best emotion in games, the holy grail, if you will, and that's that feeling of winning. Yes, I just won the Grand Prix. No word in English for that word, so I use the Italian, fiero. Your body's on fire, like the car. It's like, yes, I just got it. That emotion is really powerful for players. The third one is, of course, the win feels all that more epic if you can bring your friends along. Not surprising to anyone here in this room at South by Southwest, but basically people will play games to spend time with their friends. So the social emotions, such as schadenfreude and envy, joy, amusement is the one we measure the most, all of these are really strong, create strong social bonds between players and are a real key for why people learn. So we call that people fun. Then lastly, people play games because they create meaning and value. People play games, it turns out, to actually change themselves and change the world. When we released this model in 2004, people were playing Dance Dance Revolution, on one hand, to lose weight, and they were also playing crosswords and card games every morning to give them a mental pick-me-up in order to give them a mental workout. So they were already playing games in order to learn. Since that time, of course, we've got a number of things like Brain Age and other more educational games that have proved this out. We call this serious fun, where people play games to change themselves and change the world. Educational games have a lot of this need to have a lot of this factor. But in order to have a good game, is you want to be able to move between these different areas. So even in a game that's really hardcore and maybe you think there's not much to do with education, like Grand Theft Auto, in between the challenges, from on a mission where you're going from point A to point B, the game also offers you other things like improv theater. And this is where engagement comes in. So in the middle of the hard fun of a mission, the game offers you a freeway exit ramp. Oh, here's a plate glass window. And you've got a car. The player's a car. What do you think is going to happen? So there are these opportunities for interaction. And it's very important because if the main mission is too complex or too hard or too frustrating, then the player has another activity at hand that they can use to woohoo, just blow off some steam, have some fun, and then they can go back to the mission refreshed. And so this balancing, so you can see with the model, you see different loops. Players will go go to one loop, and then they'll go to the next loop, and then come back. And that's how games create wonderful engagement. Now, as a game designer, you can't design these emotions from play directly, which would be on the outer rim of this model, this cloverleaf. But you can, as a game designer and as a curriculum designer, design the mechanics, the choices that you offer to the player. And it's those choices that then create the emotion. So the choices are in the center, and then it moves out to the model. There's you can download this model on our website at zeodesign.com, or the letters 4K2F or 4KeysToFun.com. And we also just pushed out a copy, a poster size version you can download on Zazzle.
Okay, and just so you know, Zeo is XEO.
Right.
So XEO.com.
Yeah. X-ray, Echo, Oscar.
Oh, okay.
Design.com.
So, Scott, would you like to follow up on that?
I just want to build on what Nicole was saying. The if anybody saw Rainn Wilson's presentation last night, you know, he kept interjecting his serious talk about spirituality with these goofy off-ramps. And, you know, in any activity, if you can give yourself a little break along the way to re-engage yourself in the serious part of the activity, it's super helpful. So games give you that opportunity all the time. I think projects do, too, because especially if they're collaborative, there's always somebody, you know, giving you a chance to go goof around over there or to fool with some variable over there, and then bring it back into reality.
Well, and that amusement, if I can just interject, that amusement really is essential for team bonding. Think of ourselves as social animals. Well, the mechanics that make us social, amusement, the ability for me to amuse you and you to amuse me, that actually increases our closeness and allows us to work together more efficiently. That's just how emotions work. It's kind of strange, but there it is.
I think an answer to what's working is there's all kinds of things that are working out there. There's a zillion experiments. There's all kinds of individuals doing these experiments, you know, in the education system around the periphery. And I think one of the challenges is to figure out how to bring some of those learnings into the mainstream. On the small end of the scale, just for example, our office is participating with an after-school program called Step Inspire in Boston, and it's an underprivileged area in Roxbury, and most of these kids in middle school just don't have any real idea, you know, what they can be when they, you know, grow up. So this program is about getting kids on, you know, outside of the classroom and visiting companies around town. And we're one of the field trips where they can see how creativity can be applied and all these kind of different problems that we're working on. And that's, you know, pretty interesting. But they also asked us to teach a design project with these seventh graders, and we're in the middle of doing that now. So we have them do design research, interview each other to figure out how to address a problem, and then we did brainstorming together, and they created solutions, and now the next step is to prototype things and present their findings. So there's all kinds of these little activities that are happening by individuals out there. One step up from that, another example that we're participating in is to try to engage the industrial design community through the IDSA, our professional society, to do outreach to people's in local schools. Last year, we had the chance to do a design program at a school called NOCA, the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts. And this is really kind of a fun little story because they were, you know, the creative arts high school, half-day high school of the area. The Marsalis brothers graduated from there. You know, Harry Connick Jr. graduated from high school there. They attracted anybody that showed any sign of creativity into their half-day program. Then Katrina hit, and all the schools were wiped out. So all these charter schools moved in, and they offered, you know, arts enrichment, you know, as a, you know, a class here or there to take. So now nobody felt like they needed to send their kids to this creative arts high school, which is really an ideal environment for anybody that showed problem-solving potential. So they decided they needed just to compete with this new environment to create a core curriculum, but they decided to do it on an art studio model, and they engaged a friend of mine named Arnold Wasserman in that project, and then he had Doris Papanek and myself, another industrial designer turned learning researcher, do a design program there. And so here we had this first year of freshman students, and they need a physical classroom space for this new academic program that they're going to be designing, and the administration is interested in getting their input. So we had them, you know, do design research. We had them study the existing building. We documented everything that worked and everything that didn't work in the current facility. We talked about an ideal future environments where learning could be easy and fun. And we did brainstorming, and we did concept development, and they built our prototypes. That's one behind us now of what their ideal science classroom would be like. So that was a fun experiment, and I guess what I call kind of a program that's we're trying to distribute across the country. But then there are large-scale efforts that are going on that most of us aren't aware of. Singapore, for instance, as a country, hired my friend Arnold, and he said, if you want me to help you with your education system, I need to work with the Ministry of Government, and we're going to tear it down and rebuild it. Singapore is probably pouring more money per capita into innovation than any country in the world, and they're hiring the best thinkers in the world to change the way they teach from, because currently they get the best test scores, and they're among like the top three standardized test scoring countries in the world, but to tear that machine down and rebuild an innovation and creativity and project and design-based learning machine, because they know their future as a landlocked little country is all based on innovation. So they have to change. They're training their students to do what we historically, as Americans, have been good at, and that is think creatively, think about possibility and innovate. So they're in the process now of retooling everything because they know the future is about competing on innovation. They know the future is an innovation economy, and they're retraining the way everybody learns there as we as a country are trying to teach to a standardized test. So it's pretty crazy.
Okay, well, Heather, you know about standardized tests, and you know about how to mess them up. So can you tell us a little bit about your take on that?
Well, so really interesting what Scott just said. I wanted to point out three points that he made. So if you the question is, we know intuitively that game-like learning, incorporating elements of play, like Nicole's talked about, that resonates as something that would make schooling more fun, right, for all these kids that are bored out of their minds right now at school. But the question is, how do we actually bring them in scale into the system in a way that that can transform the system so it truly is more student-centric? Notice the three points that Scott made. He just said that he's seeing some interesting new models in the after-school space. He's seeing new models in New Orleans that was recently decimated by Hurricane Katrina, and he's seeing new models in other countries. He mentioned Singapore, which isn't a developing country. It's a developed country, but developing countries definitely. So China has a goal right now of bringing education to 100 million more students in the rural countryside. They ain't going to do that with traditional classroom instruction. I'll just break the news right now. So if you think about it, how do you get these innovations to actually get into the system? And oftentimes it begins in areas that are outside the system, after schools, students that don't have access because perhaps they were just, their schools were just wiped out by a hurricane, developing countries where the students don't have, where the alternative is literally nothing or something very inferior, and a mobile device with some programming on it would be better than nothing. And so you see the innovations start to creep in that way. If I were an entrepreneur right now, I'd be looking for those opportunities that are outside of the mainstream traditional, where you can get a foothold and then gradually, as your technology improves, start to generate some scale such that it would be compelling value proposition for the mainstream. Let me give you four examples of different schools that are starting to blend the non-traditional with the more traditional brick and mortar. The first I want to spotlight, and this is what we call blended learning, and it's really any blending of online learning with brick and mortar experiences. It makes sense that would be happening because if you think about it, most kids can't really be homeschooled. They need a place to be supervised. They need a hot lunch. There's a million things that schools do besides just deliver academic instruction. And so it makes sense that the new technologies are going to find their home eventually in a brick-and-mortar setting. So one is the KIPP LA Empower Academy. It's serving kindergartners right now. It'll scale up to fourth grade. And the way they do it is through the station rotation model, where the students do like a third of their time online, a third of their time with small group teacher-led instruction, and then a third of their time with individual instruction, like worksheets or whatever they're doing individually. So that kind of a model would allow for something like a compelling game to be during that one slot, the online learning slot, and then the students rotate to the teacher-led instruction for like application or further reinforcement of the material, and then the individual instruction. In their first pilot year, the students began as 9% proficient in reading, and by the end of the year, they were 96% proficient in reading. And part of the logic behind that is that these students are able to be grouped more appropriately for the small group time with the teacher, and also the online learning allows the students to work at their own pace. The second example I wanted to give you is Summit Public Schools. They're based in Redwood City, and they have two high schools that have been doing this another station rotation model where they alternate between Khan Academy for their math and then challenge projects. And so it's this blend of project-based learning with digital curriculum. And the class moves together as a whole. They do the Khan Academy, and then they move to these challenge projects where they're doing applied physical application of what they learned through Khan Academy. In 2011, Newsweek named Summit Prep as one of the America's top 10 miracle high schools. So they seem to be getting some attention for what they're doing. The third is a lab rotation model that I wanted to highlight in San Jose, California, called Rocket Ship Education. And you've probably heard of Rocket Ship. They've definitely been the media darling in the blended learning space. But I think that what they're doing merits some attention because they have this lab rotation that has some really interesting features. So the students would be in traditional classroom settings for most of their learning blocks, but then for 2 hours each day, they rotate to a learning lab where they do predominantly online learning. So they're doing Head Sprout, they're doing Reasoning Mind, Alex, Dreambox, Accelerated Reader, and working at their own pace with these in these online settings. And that's another little opportunity for game-like simulations, digital experiences to creep into the curriculum in a way that's working at an actual school. And then the fourth is Carpe Diem in Yuma, Arizona. It's kind of a sleepy area that the executive director himself says, you know, there's nothing really particularly noteworthy about Yuma, Arizona, until you look at what we've been able to accomplish at our school. They've set up these individual rotations that are sort of like class School of One, in that students have their individual playlist. If you walk into Carpe Diem, you see 300 cubicles that are kind of like a call center. And the students spend most of their time at these cubicles learning online with E2020 curriculum, digital online content. And then there are only six face-to-face credentialed teachers for these 273 students. And these six teachers rotate in with the students in different clusters to provide application, reinforcement, individual tutoring, small group workshops. And interestingly, with that totally different equation for how teachers are used and how the facility is designed, that school has shot to the top in the county. It's been recognized by U.S. News and World Report and a ton of other award-receiving magazines for just the amazing work that they've done in boosting those kids in Yuma, Arizona forward. So some of these new models are really hopeful, I think, for what's working in terms of actually seeing a blend of the new ideas for how students learn with some of the more traditional constructs of a brick-and-mortar setting.
Go ahead, Scott.
I wanted to comment that it's the difference between pushing information at kids in a traditional, you know, teacher at the front of the class model or this model, which is kind of funny, ironic, and the pull model where, you know, the student is deciding how fast they want to learn, how much they want to learn. They're going down this branch path at their pace. They're seeing the connections to other branches, and you don't need so many teachers. The teachers then become coaches, and the coaches can be more personal. And they can help you get unstuck, and then that's the I guess one of the little secrets of this coaching design projects is that you just walk around, you help individuals get unstuck, and then they move on and they advance faster and faster. It's easier, it's more meaningful, it's more powerful, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because that teacher role, as it's shifting, so some skeptics look at it and say, what is this going to do to the teaching profession? Is this saying that teachers aren't important? And I think that absolutely that's not what the people who are doing this in practice, like Carpe Diem, are saying. I think they're just saying that we rethink the way that the teachers support the students. And the teachers that I've spoken with who work in these online settings usually say that despite oftentimes they're being virtual, they feel way more connected with the students, and that they are able to give the students more individual attention because they connect with each student. They have their data to see where the student's doing, and they can help the student exactly where that student is, as opposed to in the traditional setting where it's sort of like one teacher versus 30 or however many, and it's hard to connect on an individual basis.
Well, thanks. We're almost out of time, so each of our panelists is going to have a closing statement, and then we're going to open it up for a few questions. We are going to run out of time pretty soon, so I wanted to, again, let's leave people with something that they can do, or what's next? What are actionable steps? Nicole, I know you can talk about that.
Great, wonderful. Well, I just following on with this conversation is that anecdotally, a lot of players tell us that they learned how to read in video games. They learn how to read playing Zelda. They learn how to read playing Mario. The little cutscenes in between gameplay, usually has some text talking about what the characters are feeling, what the goal is, and all that. A lot of learning is happening there. But in a sense, like what we do, I wanted to close with talking about why we must play. So again, games prepare us for our future selves, and that if we're going to prepare a world of citizens for the 21st century, we need to take advantage of every kind of opportunity to empower them to master new concepts. Simulation games such as SimCity or role-playing games or such as Diner Dash, where you play a waitress and go from a greasy spoon to a 5-star restaurant. When you master the content, you master the game. You're mastering that content, and they're also going to provide a new way of thinking. Once we've got simulations everywhere, we're going to be able to actually use this almost as a language to create new constructs, new ways of working with our environment, representing it. We can represent it in new ways, and we're going to be able to move those representations around. Well, look, guess what? That's a new type of thinking. I've got in the slide behind me here is a game plan to change the world, which is one of our little initiatives at Zio Design. And what you can do is you can see across the top, it says, players cause change. You can do it, fill it out as a little worksheet if you want to create a serious game for yourself. Again, this is all on ziodesign.com, xeodesign.com. You can fill it out yourself. But what is a game? Well, it's goals, it's actions, it's motivations, and emotions. And the game, basically, you loop. If you can loop those together to create a game-like experience on pretty much every kind of cause. Players cause change. So that's what I wanted to leave you with.
That's great. Thanks, Nicole. Now, Scott, can you tell us what you're up to? What we should be doing?
I'd like to challenge everybody in this audience. And everybody that I meet to engage, with a design, any kind of design-based learning opportunity you can. If you're a parent, get involved with the school and try to turn what they're learning into projects, giving context. If you're a teacher, do more projects, frame the opportunity, and let the kids build on that opportunity, find their own pathways to success, get them through the research process, all the way through prototyping and building and testing their ideas. Work with the game ideas that Nicole is presenting, and play with the system model that Heather's describing. I think what we really need to do is to help empower kids to think of themselves as creative problem solvers. We're all going to have, our kids are going to have so many jobs between, when they enter the workforce and when they leave the workforce, that any rote learning of any one activity isn't going to do it for them anymore. So they have to be able to imagine themselves taking on any kind of challenge and doing something with it. So I think if in school we can get people to get kids to think about fixing problems they care about, they're going to learn that they can, in fact, work on those problems and deliver good results. And if we can empower them to think like creative problem solvers, then they can apply this innovation methodology to really any field they want to pursue. Because innovation has to happen in government, innovation has to happen in law, innovation has to happen in social situations, and in the environment, and in engineering, and everywhere. So it's just I think all of us can be part of the solution. We just have to find that way in.
That's great. Thanks. Thank you, Scott. Now, Heather, would you like to?
Yeah, so a few thoughts for different types of people. So if I were an entrepreneur, I would really be looking for opportunities that are outside of the mainstream system, so pockets of non-consumption in the innovation lingo, where the alternative is maybe nothing or something that's way too expensive or complicated. So think about when the computer industry started with mainframe computers, and then they migrated to mini computers. And then this guy named Steve Jobs came out with the Apple IIe, and people said, that's so inferior to what a mini computer or a mainframe could do. We really don't have any need for that. And so they decided to market it initially as a children's toy. And so they were smart about getting a foothold in a market where the alternative for these kids was really not to have any computer at all. And then eventually the technology became so popular that I actually don't see any laptops in here right now that are not Apples, I think. So that's the advice for entrepreneurs, is that you want to start out small, be hungry for profit before growth, and get a foothold. If I were working for a larger company that wanted to innovate in this space, I would create an autonomous unit, one that didn't have the huge benchmarks of profitability and growth that a sustaining innovation would need, but one that could start out really small in a niche market and then grow. If I were here as someone representing a foundation or a government agency, I would look for areas where the market doesn't produce signals or incentives for entrepreneurs, and only use my money to support those areas, as opposed to funding projects that the market already is sending plenty of strong signals to for people to act in that space, such as in developing content. That's an area that's being super rewarded right now by the market, or at least moderately rewarded right now by the market, and yet areas like developing really strong assessment systems, not so much. So that's where I would focus if I were a foundation. And then for technologists that just want to focus on supply side tools, I think there's a really exciting opportunity right now. This ecosystem with this mixture of digital learning, modular learning, the idea of choose your own modality that might include and hopefully will include more project-based learning and contextual learning. It's a new space and something that we haven't seen in the education sector for, like I said, 150 years. So there's huge opportunities here on the supply side to build out the tools.
Thank you, Heather. We have time for about maybe one or two questions at the most. If you'd like to, please go to the microphone so you're on the podcast and you will be immortalized. We did start a couple minutes late, but we do need to end on time.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
It was actually quite interesting. Yesterday, Peter Diomedes was talking about the X Prize and how he said we're genetically wired to compete. And it was fascinating. One of the young ladies in the question period came up and sort of challenged him on that, saying, I have no interest in competing. I'm the most collaborative person. And she basically called him on it and said, that's a guy thing. So what other opportunities for me are there? So I guess my question is, kind of comment on that. And how do we maybe engage those people like her that at least don't believe that they are they're competitive or they want to collaborate?
That's a great question. It's often assumed that women don't want to compete, and I think it's more in the type of competition we're talking about than the actual fact. But if you get into People Fund in the Four Keys, we have competition, competitive mechanics. We also have cooperative ones. And there are a lot of games that have cooperative, where we're working together to pursue a common goal. And really, I like to think about, especially as a designer, when I'm thinking about designing competition, is going back to the real definition of that term, which means to come together, to pursue a common, to build or to improve ourselves, to, pursue a common goal. And so it's not just head-to-head, but we're each individually getting better on ourselves, on our path, in order to, to reach that thing. If you don't want any competition at all, games, what they do is we do co-ops. So the three of us are against the bad guys that are in the computer. So we have completely collaborative emotions, because we're working together on the couch against the bad guy that's on the computer.
I don't believe that. I believe that it is in our DNA to compete, because you can compete with yourself. You know, your personal best is a competition with yourself to achieve. You can compete to be more collaborative. You know, you can have teams that are working on their collaboration skills. I think there's that competition, even if it's with yourself, is ingrained, and you want to take advantage of that feeling.
One quick thought too, and that is that one of the places that we're finding that online learning is taking off, or the most successful, is with inner city Black men, because there's a culture and an ethic of it's not cool to be academically accomplished, and so the privacy that accomplishment can bring in a virtual setting allows these kids to really move forward in a way that's socially acceptable. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I wonder if any of you would talk about, there's a sort of very finite, short task, fixed stuff that can occur in some of the game stuff and online learning you're talking about, and yet Scott, I guess, it talks a lot about, and Heather's also talked about, very open-ended, choose your own design, pick your project, and go where you go. I sort of think of some kind of leveling up path between those, where you can take someone who's fairly unmotivated, doesn't know where they want to go, doesn't know what they're doing, and move them to a place where they can choose. But
okay, I just want to mention that I'm afraid this will have to be our last question, and then we'll be wrapping up.
I think that what Heather mentioned as in her Khan Academy example and the rotation into project work is a method to address that question. So, you know, you do this virtual thing, then you do something physical, virtual, physical, virtual, physical. And I think what's interesting about Khan is my kids both use it, and they think it's a really nice addition to what they're learning in class. But there's something also, and no one talks about it very much, this kind of magical thing that appears over time on your display. You know, it's like a reveal in a way that starts to get at some game. There's so much game potential in what he's doing and what we could do out there that can then be tied back into the physical world and the path that any student wants to take. If you look at engineering tools like LabVIEW, you make something physical, you connect it with sensors, and you can start playing with variables. So here we're virtual, we're physical, and those kind of simulations, again, are amazingly powerful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And in fact, there are five things you need to do to create a game, really simply, is that you simplify the world, you suspend the consequences, you clarify the goal, and then you enhance the feedback. If you do those things, you can actually create a game. And then once you're there to create motivation, to increase motivation, is that you're offering new challenges, like Scott was saying before, but there's also, there's problem solving, right? But there's also system thinking, and games are uniquely also qualified for teaching mastery on system thinking, and that can be powerfully motivating as well.
Heather, would you like to wrap it up for us there?
Well, I think they captured what I was going to say. So.
Well, but okay, then if you could each maybe give me like 140 character comments that everybody in the room can tweet out today to close, and then we'll everybody be happy to talk to you afterwards. So. And we do have emails and Twitter handles on the screen right now if you check them out. Scott, why don't we start with you? Because you were the least tweeting kind of guy I know in this room.
I know. I got to work on that. Empower kids to think of themselves as creative problem solvers.
What makes games engaging is they offer novelty, challenge, social and interaction, and meaning. And you can use these two games to change yourself or change the world.
Great, Heather.
And these types of student-centric learning are possible, but you have to be strategic about how to actually break into an impenetrable system.
Okay, well, let's thank our panelists for a wonderful...
Thank you.